Good evening. It is good to see everyone that is out. To those of you who are members, I go along with Brother Harold. Maybe some of you need to just kind of swap sides. I told Anna she needs to sit on the other side, Nick, for the rest of this week. But it is good to see everyone that is here. We're very appreciative of all of our members that are here. We're thankful especially for all of our visitors that are here. We want to remind you that all of these sermons will be, barring any technical difficulties, available on CD. They're also available for download on the web at truthandright.org. Just a quick word about that. For those of you who might be interested, we've already had several that have been listening to the lessons. I've already received word that they're listening. It's just great to know that the word is getting out even beyond the doors of this building. And let's continue to pray for the meeting. I'm going to try and keep my remarks short entering into this because we've got a lot of ground to cover. This was the sermon out of all of these that I was the most concerned with because it's a big subject. As I mentioned Sunday morning in our lesson, we've reached a time where it is time, past time, well past time, for Christians to stand up and say, I believe in God. It is past time for us to stand against the teachings of the school systems, to stand against the way that the world is trying to be run against us. And so tonight we're asking the question, is there a God? This is a question that has plagued mankind from the very beginning. You go back throughout history and you look at the various peoples that have walked upon this earth and they've created various answers to that question. You look at the Eastern gods, Buddha, and the gods of the Hindus. You look at the gods of the Romans and the Greeks, the gods of the Native Americans. All of them have created something that they thought referred to a higher power, something that they thought was there to create the world, something, some kind of supreme deity. It's interesting, even when you look at the Native American gods, they had a supreme god over all of their lesser gods. You've got the God of the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians, where they all believe in a supreme deity, one God. But it wasn't too long ago, back in 1966, some of y'all may remember seeing this on the newsstand, when Time magazine came out with the article, Is God Dead? Various others have tried to say God is dead. Others have tried to say that there is no need for God. This all began to come about through the work of Charles Darwin and various others who followed after him and teaching evolution, showing that there is no need for a supreme creator. There is no need for God. And as we look at these things, we can see that as time has progressed, that our children are being indoctrinated through various television shows and movies. Shows such as Zaboomafoo, The Magic School Bus, The Land Before Time, Dinosaur Train, the movie Dinosaur, and those blockbuster hits, Ice Age 1, 2, and 3. Each of these try to tell our kids that the earth is billions of years old. Each of these try to tell our children and us that dinosaurs walked the earth millions of years ago, long before man. These that seem to be just innocent little educational programs are being used by scientists, by the educational forces that are at work in this, to tell our children we evolved from pond scum. To tell our children that we evolved from apes, that we're nothing more than the supreme being upon this earth. If you watch the Discovery Channel, other things, you see this time and time again. Even our own Smithsonian Institute. If you go and tour their section on dinosaurs, you will not see any alternating ages. All it will present is that dinosaurs walked the earth 300, 400, 500, 600 million years ago. When Brooklyn and I toured it in Washington, D.C., I had to walk through. She was just three or four years old. I told her, I said, these dates aren't right. But you look at the world, and they will state that evolution is a fact. When you walk around and you ask various people in the world, you ask them, how old is the earth? And many of them will answer, well, it's about 4.5 to 5 billion years old. That's the answer that you'll receive from scientists. That's the answer that you'll receive from the common man on the street, because they've been told through television programs, through movies, through the school systems, that the earth is billions and billions of years old, that evolution has been taking place for many, many years. Even some who claim to believe in God, who claim to believe that the Scriptures are the inspired Word of God, try to fit 4.5 to 5 billion years in Genesis chapter 1 and say that God used evolution to create this world. Well, we've got a big task ahead of us this evening. Our study this evening is going to be following along the same line that the Apostle Paul used there in Acts chapter 17 when he came into the city of Athens. He didn't open to the Old Testament Scriptures. He didn't refer to the Jewish teachings. He used their own teachings to tell them of God. So, if you would, join with me as we look at these things. And we ask the question, is there a God? We're going to begin by looking at this. A fellow by the name of Richard Dawkins. Famous throughout England, famous throughout the educational world, and made a little famous by Ben Stein and others from various movies that he's appeared in. Richard Dawkins in the British... The British Humanist Association got together and put together this campaign. I told the members of the congregation about this a while back, where all the double-decker buses, all the bendies, as they call them over there, all these buses throughout England, and their campaign is beginning to be carried out into the world, putting this slogan on the sides of buses saying, "There probably is no God, and now stop worrying and enjoy life." When I was reading about this several months ago in the article, if I remember correctly, Richard Dawkins was saying that, you know, he really pushed to say there is no God, but they couldn't use that because the truth in advertising that even the Britons have would not allow that to go. So they had to lighten it up. There's a little bit there in that he realized that he couldn't prove that there is no God. And we're going to look at that some more. Richard Dawkins has written the book, The Blind Watchmaker and the God Delusion. The Blind Watchmaker is his attempt to refute the idea of how people use the making of a watch, intelligent design. And I guess I tried to find a copy of it and wasn't able to, but from what I could read online, he's presenting the idea that even a blind man could make a watch if he took long enough. Dawkins has said that among the things that science does know, evolution is about as certain as anything we know. When questioned by Bill Moyers in this interview about why it's still called a theory, Dawkins replied and said evolution has been observed. It's just that it hasn't been observed while it's happening. Dawkins has said that intelligent design is not a scientific argument at all, but a religious one. That's why he's the biggest proponent for making sure that intelligent design is not taught in any educational facility anywhere in the world that he can get a hold of. This is what we're up against. These are the things that are out there. And unfortunately, the public school systems fall right in line with this train of thought, presenting the geologic record that mankind has created over a period of time as fact. You most likely will not be presented with a young earth point of view in the local school systems. And when you go on into university, it just gets worse. It wasn't too long ago, it was reported that a professor from the University of Texas instructed his students to never cite a religious science source such as ICR, Answers in Genesis, or anything else like that. If the thesis of your paper is anti-evolutionary, which he likened to arguing against the germ theory of disease or against the atomic theory of matter, you will receive a failing grade. This is what we're sending our young people into to face when they walk through the doors of the various colleges. Further, it's been said by Michael L. Deeney, a professor in Texas, associate professor of biology. He made this statement. He said, "Someone who denies evolution has committed malpractice regarding the method of science. How can someone who denies the theory of evolution, the very pinnacle of modern biological science, ask to be recommended into a scientific profession by a professional scientist?" He went on to say that the central unifying principle of biology is the theory of evolution. How can someone who does not accept the most important theory in biology expect to be properly practice in a field that is so heavily based on biology? In fact, you go to his web page for Texas Tech University and look at his requirements to get a letter of recommendation so that you can go on to med school. This is what you'll find. He says, if you set up an appointment to discuss the writing of a letter of recommendation, I will ask you, how do you think the human species originated? If you cannot truthfully and forthrightly affirm a scientific answer to this question, then you should not seek my recommendation for admittance to further education in the biomedical sciences. In other words, if you're going to Texas Tech University and you want to go into med school and you want this professor to write you a letter of recommendation, you have to state truthfully that evolution is a fact, that you believe it to be the answer. John W. Patterson, a former professor at Iowa State University, in 1984 in Liberty Magazine in the November-December issue, put this, the emphasis are mine, he said, I suggest that every professor should reserve the right to fail any student in his class, no matter what the grade record indicates, whenever basic misunderstandings of a certain magnitude are discovered. Moreover, I would propose retracting grades and possibly even degrees if such gross misunderstandings are publicly espoused after the passing the course or after being graduated. In other words, if you graduate from his class and you graduate from Iowa University and you go on and you begin to speak publicly that you don't believe in the theory of evolution, he says, let's take away their degrees. He goes on to say, in geology and biology, denying the facts of evolution or an earth age in the order of billions of years would, in my view, be grounds for drastic action. Resorting to arguments based on religious commitments, personal inspirations, revelations, and such would not be acceptable defenses. However logically coherent arguments based on valid evidence could be, decisions as to what is logically coherent and what is valid evidence would have to be made by appropriate faculty experts or panels who might also be called to task if their rationales reflect academic irresponsibility or scholarly incompetence. Basically, he says, all right, what we're going to do is if you present something, we're going to have a panel, and if it's against evolution, we're going to throw you out. And if someone on that panel begins to disagree with evolution, we're going to throw them out too. That's what our children are facing in the universities. That's what the world is presenting. We could go on looking hour after hour. I can tell you I've got a stack of papers on my desk, books that just give all kinds. This is just a synopsis, folks, of the attitudes in the educational field and in the science field towards those that want to believe in creation, that want to stand against evolution. So if all scientists believe evolution to be true, then it has to be true, right? If all the scientists say, yes, we've proven that evolution is true, yes, we've got the facts, then it's got to be true. Well, you see, there's a problem. It has to be based on the scientific method. The scientific method is a way that they go through and they prove theories as facts. You might remember from your science classes, characterization, that is that you observe things, you define them, you get measurements of the subject of inquiry, then you build your hypothesis. This is your theoretical, hypothetical explanations of observations and measurements of the subject. This is what you think is going to take place. Then you give your predictions further, proposing what you think will happen. If you do this to this, this is what will happen. And then you run your experiments and it either proves your theory correct or it proves it wrong. It's oftentimes broken down into more steps. Looking at defining the question, gathering information and resources about the subject, forming a hypothesis, performing an experiment, analyzing the data from the experiment, interpreting that data and drawing conclusions, and then if it doesn't draw the conclusions that your hypothesis said was supposed to happen, you're supposed to go back and form another hypothesis and then work your way through again. Where have they ever performed an experiment that set the theory of evolution as correct. That's an experiment that would take several billion years, would it not? Oh, but evolution is based on fact. We know it's to be true. That's why we still should be calling it the theory of evolution. It's a theory, folks. I don't care what they say in the science classes. I don't care what they call it in the schools. It's still a theory. It's still the Big Bang theory. Now, to listen to scientists, they'll disagree and go, no, we've proven it. No, you haven't. Show us the facts. Show us the experiments. Show us how you've proven these things to be true. Well, that brings us to another question before we move on in our lesson. Is it true that all scientists believe in Darwin's theory of evolution? Came across this in my studies. And the answer to that is a categorical no. Now, when you watch your television programs on Discovery and the History Channel and all these other scientific programs, when you let your kids watch these television programs, they'll all set out and say all of science agrees that evolution is a fact, that Darwin's theory of evolution is correct. But you can go to www.discovery.org and read this. This is a statement. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. And then you can begin to look at the long list of all the names and their various degrees, where they teach, where they work, of individuals who have signed this petition saying, we don't believe Darwin's theory of evolution to be true. We don't even think it's a very good explanation for life as we know it today. In fact, we can read on that website. It says, during recent decades, new scientific evidence from many scientific disciplines such as cosmology, physics, biology, artificial intelligence research, and others have caused scientists to begin questioning Darwinism's central tenet of natural selection and studying the evidence supporting it in greater detail. Yet, public TV programs, educational policy statements, and science textbooks have asserted that Darwin's theory of evolution fully explains the complexity of living things. The public has been assured that all known evidence supports Darwinism and that virtually every scientist in the world believes the theory to be true. The scientists on this list dispute the first claim and stand as living testimony in contradiction to the second. Since Discovery Institute launched this list in 2001, hundreds of scientists have courageously stepped forward to sign their names. The list is growing and includes scientists from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Russian, Hungarian, and Czech National Academies, as well as from universities such as Yale, Princeton, Stanford, MIT, UC Berkeley, UCLA, and others. One important thing for you to realize, when these scientists signed this list, they put a mark, a target, on their back. They put their jobs at risk. This is not a couple of scientists getting together and having some fun. Their job, their livelihood is at risk in their stating that we don't believe in the theory of evolution. It's going to go on for about 5 more pages. But we need to press on. As we look at things, we can see it's not just scientists. But there's also a group of physicians and surgeons. People who deal with the anatomy of man on a daily basis, they devoted their lives to a study of the anatomy of man, who also descent from Darwin. Their statement is, we are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the origination and complexity of life, and therefore we dissent from Darwinian macroevolution as a viable theory. This does not imply the endorsement of any alternative theory. And that's important for us to realize, all those scientists and these doctors, they're not saying creationism is necessarily the way. They're saying we don't see the facts for Darwinian evolution that science is trying to cram down everyone's throats. And the list for them is equally numerous. Almost 300 scientists on the one. I didn't take the time to count all the names here. But you've got doctors from all different walks of life. And once again, they are putting targets on their back in their willingness to sign this petition and to say, we disagree. To me, it doesn't take much to look at the complexity of our own bodies and know that it did not come about as chance. So, if science has proven it as fact, why do so many scientists, doctors, disagree? See, we need to understand something. Evolution is nothing more than a system of faith. Now, you talk to the likes of Richard Dawkins and other scientists, and they go, no, there's no faith involved. We're looking at cold, hard facts. Well, I'm going to present to you, to the best of my ability, just exactly how much faith is involved in following after the theory of evolution. You see, when we look at these things, we can see faith as something that is believed strongly, especially with strong conviction. Belief is conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination of evidence. You see, evolution's built on really shaky ground. Because if you take time out of the equation, evolution falls apart. You see, evolution has to have billions and billions of years. That's why every 5-10 years you continue to look and you'll see where they've gone from the world's just millions of years old to the world is billions of 1.5 billion years old. Now they're saying it's 4.5 to 5 billion. Because the more they look at it, the more they see they have to have this large period of time. Interestingly, George G. Simpson, who was a noted champion of evolutionary dogma, said that when he was discussing mutations as a mechanism to explain evolution, he said that if you had a breeding population of 100 million individuals, and they had the capacity to produce a new generation every day, good evolutionary results would be about once every 274 billion years. And yet science tell you it's only 4.5 to 5 billion years old. In other words, we shouldn't have even reached the first stage of good evolutionary results. This is a man who believes in evolution. And he admits this is what it would take. You see, time is the cornerstone of evolution. You see, the theory of evolution is entirely dependent on the earth having been around for billions and billions of years. Evolution needs time like creation needs God. You can't have creation without God. You can't have evolution without time. Wayne Jackson presents an interesting analogy in his book, Creation, Evolution, and the Age of the Earth. He suggests that you take 1,000 pieces of paper, 8x10 pieces of paper, and you go up at an altitude in an airplane flying about 5,000 feet and you drop them from that airplane. He says, what are the chances that those papers will form the phrase, in the beginning God, when they land on the earth? Well, any person in statistics will tell you it's in the billions. One in a billion or more chances that it's going to fall down and you can read that phrase, in the beginning God. But let's give it more time. Instead of dropping it at 5,000, let's take the airplane up to 10,000. Therefore, giving the papers more time as they fall down to the earth, does that make it more likely that it's going to say, in the beginning, God? Anybody with half a brain is going to go, no, that increases the chances even more. You see, that's what evolution is trying to do. They're saying if you give it enough time, even a blind man can build a watch. Given enough time, the monkeys can type out all the works of Shakespeare. Given enough time. But do they have enough time? Have they found the time that they're needing? You see, scientists, you talk to them, oh, we have proven that the age of the earth is around 4.5 to 5 billion years old. But have they? Once again, where's the proof? What proof do they offer? They use tests such as radioisotope dating, radiometric, carbon-14, and other methods to date rocks and fossils. These are tried, tested, and found to be true, right? That's what science will tell you. And that's what some Christians will tell you. Because they'll take those billions of years and cram them into the days of Genesis chapter 1. They'll say, well, these things must be right, therefore we've got to put this period of time into Genesis chapter 1. However, you'd be wrong to believe that these methods of dating have been proven to be accurate. It's interesting, when you look at the information that's provided, you seldom find anything talking about the inaccuracy of the dating methods. Dr. Stephen Morbath, a professor at the University of Oxford, also an evolutionist, said that there are no terrestrial rocks closely approaching an age of 4.6 billion years that have been yet discovered. The evidence for the age of the earth is circumstantial, being based upon indirect reasoning. I love it when science is honest. I love it that when a scientist, even when he disagrees with you, he tells you the truth. He's honest. John Eddy, an evolutionary astronomer, said there is no evidence based solely on solar observations that the sun is 4.5 to 5 billion years old. I suspect that the sun is 4.5 billion years old. However, given some new and unexpected results to the contrary, and some time for frantic recalculation and theoretical readjustment, I suspect that we could live with Bishop Usher's value for the age of the earth and sun. That's about 4,000 years. I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with the fact that the earth is possibly 4,000 years old or 6,000 years old. He says, if you can show us the fact, we can change what we've been looking at, we can reconfigure things, and we can make science fit it. Amazing. But yet they believe their dates to be true. You see, one of the things we need to understand is that every single one of the methods that are used to date these rocks, to date these fossils, are based on an assumption. You know what an assumption is? It's the termite of relationships. Assumptions destroy things. An assumption is a fact or statement taken for granted. In other words, we have no proof. We just have this statement. We're going to take it for granted that it's true. Radiometric methods for dating rocks and fossils are based on the decay sequences of elements found within the rocks. One of the ones that they use is that uranium-238, designated by science a parent element, given a lengthy period of time, will change into lead-206, which is called a daughter element. In other words, over time, uranium-238 turns into lead-206. And science believes that they know exactly how long that takes. That's assumption number one. Assumption number one is that they believe they know how long it takes for uranium-238 to turn into lead-206. They believe they know. That's one of the assumptions that they use in dating. Assumption number two is that it must be assumed that there was no lead-206 at the formation of that rock. Because if there was lead there in the beginning, then that throws their ratios off. You see, they take what is remaining of the uranium-238 and they divide the lead-206, they get the ratio of that, and that's how they figure out exactly how old it is. But you see, if there's already lead in that rock when it was first formed, their calculations are off. Assumption number three is that nothing has occurred to the rock to alter the parent or daughter element since the beginning. Now, according to science, we're dealing with 4.5 to 5 billion years, and they're assuming that this rock has been in a closed environment and nothing has happened to it to alter the parent or the daughter elements. I can't even guarantee you that there's nothing been done to alter the drinks that I drink. It's a pretty big assumption. Assumption number four is that decay rates are constant from formation to present. In other words, it decays at exactly the same rate from the very beginning all the way to the end. Over 4.5 to 5 billion years, that decay rate has not changed one bit. They're assuming it has been at a constant from beginning until the end. And so when they tell you that this rock is a billion years old, you ask them, how do you know? Well, we ran these tests and it told us that it was 4.5 or it was 1.5 billion years old. Well, how do you know that something didn't happen to that rock? How do you know that that daughter element wasn't there at the beginning? How do you know? We don't. Then you can't prove to me that that rock is 1 billion years old. You see, that's the thing. Evolution is based on faith. Evolutionist Frederick B. Juneman said that the age of our globe is presently thought to be some 4.5 billion years based on radio decay rates of uranium and thorium. Such confirmation may be short-lived as nature is not to be discovered quite so easily. Once again, I love an honest scientist. There has been in recent years the horrible realization that radio decay rates are not as constant as previously thought, nor are they immune to environmental influences. And this could mean that the atomic clocks are reset during some global disaster and events which brought the Mesozoic age to a close may not be 65 million years ago, but rather within the age and memory of man. Did you catch that phrase? Some global disaster? Genesis 6, 7, and 8 ring a bell with anyone? Global flood? Perhaps reset the atomic clock? And all these things that we thought to be true could be... Well, they could be more recent than we thought. But even with all these assumptions, science is using all these different methods and they're looking through surely that they can arrive at the same age with all these different methods and they can go, okay, well if this one says this and this one says this, then it must be right. Right? You'd think. Wouldn't you? Cardenas Labus in Grand Canyon. They used the potassium-argon method and determined that the flow could be as old as 860 million years. When they used the rubidium-strontium technique, they determined it could be as old as 1,160 million years. That's 300 million years difference. You think they're accurate? That's like a 100-pound woman going and getting on a scale and it's saying, you're 300 million pounds. You're going to keep that scale? I don't want to be in the room when that scale starts a-flying. And yet science says, we can accept that. Basalt rock from Nigeria. Using conventional geology, that is, they look at where it's found, the stratus and everything, and where it's found. It was found in the upper tertiary region, which put it anywhere from 2 to 26 million years old. Can you imagine somebody standing out at the fair saying, all right, I'm going to guess your age. You're between 2 and 8,000. From 2 to 26 million years. Using fishing tracks. That's not fishing like that. That's a different kind of thing. Using fishing tracks, they discovered it was less than 30 million years. So that they fit, 26 million, 30 million. Okay, we'll give them a 4 million difference there. So those two, they've got to be pretty close to being correct, right? Right? As we look further, we can see they used the potassium-argon method. Discovered it was 95 million years old. Then they used uranium-helium. And they discovered it was 750 million years old. Possibly 2 million. To 26 million, under 30 million, 95 million, 750 million. Same rock! Yeah. They've got it down to a science, don't they? Well, let's quickly go on through. When we look at these things, we can see what happens when they get all these differing results. What do? 300 million, 30 million, 750 million, what do? Well, we throw out the one that we don't like. The one that doesn't fit. A man by the name of Hayatsu said, in conventional interpretation of potassium argon age date, it is common to discard ages which are substantially too high or too low compared with the rest of the group or with other available data, such as the geologic time scale. The discrepancies between the rejected and the accepted are arbitrarily attributed to excess or loss of argon. He just said it. If it doesn't fit where we think it should. Remember, the geologic time scale is made by man. It was designed by man. They came up with it. If that bone doesn't fit within the age that they think it should, they throw it out and choose the date that does fit. But we're not done. Basaltic rocks from Hawaii that are known to have formed less than 200 years ago. We know when they were created. This is lava. We know when this happened. Less than 200 years. Using potassium argon, it was dated between 160 million to almost 3 billion years. To me, that's a pretty good test case. We know this rock is this old, and our tests are saying it's 160 to almost 3 billion years old. It's time to throw out the test. We've proven that it's not right. Oh, but we're not done. Volcanic rock from Azores and Vesuvius. Within the history of man, we know when these things occurred. We know that they're of a relatively young age. But when it was tested, it gave ages anywhere from 100 million to 1.5 billion years. Shells of living mollusk. They're still alive. Okay? They checked them with these dating methods that they have. It turned up dates of 2,300 years. That means these mollusks make Methuselah look like a baby. These mollusks have been on the earth since before Jesus walked the earth, according to their dating methods. Looking at freshly killed seals that have been dated at 1,300 years. They just killed them. They know that they're not 1,300 years. And yet, that's what they get. Looking at seals that have been mummified, that have been dead for 30 years, revealed dates as old as 4,600. That means those seals were 44,570 years old when they died. Here's one of the most interesting ones for me. A mummified muskox that was discovered in Alaska. They checked the muscle tissue there underneath the scalp. Had a radiocarbon age of 24,000. And you remember that? Because then they checked some hair off of a hind limb. It was 7,200. Now folks, I thought it was bad to start going bald at 24, 25. This fella walked around bald for 16,000 years before he grew hair. It's humorous. And these are things that they don't want being put out there. Wood from growing trees. They're still alive. Using carbon-14 was dated at 10,000 years. It's interesting because the oldest known tree is around 4,900 years. That was done by counting the rings. Interesting little fact. Did you know that they don't always just produce one ring every year? Sometimes they'll produce two. So 4,900 is a rather generous estimate on the age of this tree. And yet living trees are being aged at 10,000 years. Frolic Rainey stated, many archaeologists still think of radiocarbon dating as a scientific technique that must be either right or wrong. Would that it were so simple. He states 1870 BC, plus or minus 6, is the earliest actual recorded date in human history. He says the earliest date that we can know for sure And we know there was time before that, but the earliest date we can know for sure is 1870. Once again, I love an honest scientist. You see, you can clearly see that there's a great amount of faith involved in believing the theory of evolution. Faith in those scientists. Faith in the assumptions, the numerous assumptions that they make. Faith in the dating methods that they use. But what about old T-Rex? Every little boy loves dinosaurs. They walked the earth 30 million, 300 million, 65 million years ago. From 230 to 65 million years ago, they walked the earth. That's what science will tell you. You watch movies like Jurassic Park, and they go, yeah, we're recreating stuff that's been dead for over 65 million years. Well, if television tells you, it's got to be true, right? They wouldn't put anything false on television. They wouldn't give you false information in the movies now, would they? If they presented as fact on television and in the movies, it's got to be true, right? According to scientists, as I mentioned, dinosaurs walked the earth over 30 million years before man. Now, when we look at things, it's interesting. Let's remember what they're using to date the ages of these dinosaurs. Radiocarbon dating, carbon-14, radioisotope, radiometric, which we've already seen show huge gaps in the aging process. But what if we were able to find a bone, a dinosaur bone, that isn't fossilized? What if we were able to find a bone that still had red blood cells in it? Surely red blood cells would not last for 30 million, 60 million years, right? They would decay, wouldn't they? But in fact, in 1990, they found one. Not just one, several. Sections of the bone that had not been completely fossilized were found to contain what they believed to be blood cells. It said, to find unfossilized dinosaur bones is already an indication more consistent with a young age for the fossils. These are scientists, folks. The evidence that hemoglobin has indeed survived in this dinosaur bone would cast doubt, immense doubt, upon the millions of years idea. It says, the evidence is as follows. The tissue was colored reddish-brown, the color of hemoglobin, as was liquid extracted from the dinosaur tissue. Hemoglobin contains heme units. Chemical signatures unique to heme were found in the specimens when certain wavelengths of laser light were applied. Because it contains iron, heme reacts to magnetic fields differently from other proteins. Extracts from this specimen reacted in the same way as modern heme compounds. To ensure that the samples had not been contaminated with certain bacteria, which also have heme, but never the protein hemoglobin, extracts of the dinosaur fossil were injected over several weeks into rats. If there was even a minute amount of hemoglobin present in the T-Rex sample, the rat's immune system should build up detectable antibodies against this compound. This is exactly what happened in carefully controlled experiments. They say this could be hemoglobin from something else. Could be a bacteria got in there. So they ran tests that would prove that it was not bacteria. And those tests came out to be the proof. They go on to say evidence of hemoglobin in the still recognizable shapes of red blood cells and unfossilized dinosaur bone is powerful testimony against the whole idea of dinosaurs living millions of years ago. Now, just so you know, I've got a lot more information than I could say on dinosaurs, but if you look at the clock, we're going to leave it out. That's why I didn't have it in my notes. But it's interesting, when you look at the idea of dragons that have been throughout the history of man, according to some Chinese records, emperors used dragons to pull their chariots. There were families that raised dragons. Could it not be that dinosaurs walked in the earth with man? You might ask, well, how old are dinosaurs? Well, they were created on day six, just like man. When all living creatures that walk on the face of this earth, all land-dwelling creatures were created, that's when dinosaurs were created. So, is there a God? We've shown that it takes a great amount of faith to believe in evolution, that when you look at all the things that they use to prove evolution and how much shaky ground it's on, can we say that there is a God? How can we know that there is a God? What evidence is there for God? What evidence is there for an intelligent designer? Have you taken a look around lately? Is the world walking around with its eyes closed? The evidence is all around us. The evidence is under the microscope. Remember this from school? Bacterial flagellum? These little hairs that spin and move the bacteria around? That little motor there. Flagellum's propeller can spin at 10,000 RPM, stop spinning within a quarter turn, and instantly start spinning in the opposite direction at 10,000 RPM. Man, in all of his abilities, has not reached that. In all the intelligence that man has, in fact, it's been said that this is the most efficient machine in the universe. And it came about through chance. Really? That design, those abilities, came about by chance? Behe says, if the creation of a simple device like a mousetrap requires intelligent design, then we have to ask, what about the finely tuned machines of the cellular world? Just examine the human body. Think about that for just a moment. You look at the way the human body works together there. You look at the compound eye that we have there and the abilities that it has to turn all these things into pictures and help us to be able to see. My father just recently had cataract surgery on both eyes and he's just so happy that he can drive without wearing glasses. He's been wearing glasses since he was 12 years old. He thinks this is just the greatest thing in the world. Especially since he gets to rub it in on my older brother who just had to get glasses. The eye is an amazing thing. So amazing that even Darwin said to suppose that the eye with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. Now, if we leave it just at that, we're looking and seeing that Darwin admitted that it's impossible. I don't want to be that kind of an individual. I try to look at all that Darwin says. He goes on. A lot of times you read that all by itself. He goes on to say, yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor can be shown to exist. If further, the eye does vary ever so slightly and the variations be inherited, which is certainly the case, and if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, can hardly be considered real. Did you see how many times he said, if this happened, and then if that happened, then I could believe? That's a lot of faith, folks. It's a lot of faith. It's been 150 years since Darwin. Where is the evidence for the changing of the eye? It's still not there. Let's go back to Mr. Richard Dawkins. He was the man in the picture with the bus. In discussing the Cambrian explosion, where scientists freely admit that over a half billion animals suddenly appear in the fossil record. There's nothing that we can find before that. These fossils just suddenly appear in the record. He says this. The majority of animal phyla already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. Evolutionists of all stripes believe, however, that this really does represent a very large gap in the fossil record. Did you see that? He didn't say evolutionists of all stripes know, or evolutionists of all stripes have proven. Faith, folks. Right there in what he says, evolutionists of all stripes believe that this represents this. And I'm going to say, I don't want to misquote anyone. I don't want to cut someone's quotes. I try to give everything that they say that is necessary to get their thoughts and intents across. But once again, he says, they believe. So why is it so hard to believe in intelligent design? I want to propose a couple of off-the-wall ideas to you, okay? Because I believe the evidence for intelligent design is all around us. What about the Great Wall of China? The ancient Inca city of Machu Picchu? And the Native American cliff dwellings over in the West? Now, according to science, the Great Wall of China was built around the 8th to 5th century B.C. The Anasazi built the cliff dwellings around 1260 A.D., and historians claim that the Incas built Machu Picchu beginning around 1430 A.D. I, however, propose that these all came about all on their own. That over billions of years, particles of dust came together to form the brick, to form the walls, to form the Great Wall of China. In an orderly fashion. Oh, but we've got proof. We've got pictures of them building it. They drew the pictures. Well, I can draw a picture of me building the Eiffel Tower. Are you going to believe that? Oh, but we've gone down and we've studied some tree rings there of some beams that they used in the cliff dwellings. And we've discovered that they're that old. Okay, so they found these cliff dwellings and they put some beams in it. Do you see where I'm going with this? When you tell someone that the Great Wall of China just came about through chance over billions of years, they laugh at you in your face. And then they'll turn around and say that organisms came together over a period of billions of years from single cells to multiple cells to become the great and wonderful human being that I am. That's not ludicrous. That's not crazy. Proof of God is in everything we see. Proof that there is an intelligent being who created the world is in everything that we touch, breathe, study, and find. Why then don't scientists admit the possibility of God? You know why? They just don't want to. I firmly believe they don't want to admit that something somewhere out there is smarter than they are. They'll do anything they can to reject it. Now, I appreciate your patience with me so far. I've got one more thing I'd like to go through just to show you how far scientists are willing to go to take God out of the equation. This is an exchange that took place at the end of the movie Expelled by Ben Stein. Brother Ed, you're going to remember this. Some of you others may have watched this. If you haven't, I suggest watch it. It's an excellent piece on intelligent design and all the problems that are going on in the universities. Stein is interviewing Richard Dawkins there at the end. And Stein asks him, he says, "Well then, who did create the heavens and the earth?" And Dawkins says, "Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who." Stein says, "Well then, how did it get created?" "Well, by a very slow process. Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of event that it must have..." You catch that? "We know the kind of event. We know the kind of event that it must have been." That's... We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life. Stein asked, what was that? Dawkins says it was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule. Stein says, right, and how did that happen? Dawkins says, I told you. We don't know. So you have no idea how it started? No, nor has anybody. Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that there's an intelligent design, that there's an intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or Darwinian evolution? And this is where he goes crazy. All right? Well, it would come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto planets, perhaps this planet. Did you hear what he just said? Aliens. Aliens developed through Darwinian evolution. Where did they start? Some other aliens probably started them too. And they came to this earth and planted the seed. You see how far they will go to just reject the idea of God. Now that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility, and I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that. If you look at the details of biochemistry and molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer. But that designer would have to be an alien, is what he says. That designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe, but that higher intelligence would itself had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process. He couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point. Well, I agree. God is. Always has been. Not too hard to follow. Stein then questions Dawkins about the existence of God, whether it be the Hebrew God of the Old Testament or the Holy Trinity of the New Testament or Hindu gods. Dawkins denies the existence of any of them. How can you ask such a question, he says. How could I? Why would I? Given that I don't believe in any others. Given any possibility of any God all the way across the board, he says, nope, not going to accept it. Stein says, well, I just wanted to be sure, so you don't believe in any God anywhere. Any God anywhere would be completely incompatible with anything that I've said. Stein, I just wanted to make sure you don't believe in any God anywhere. No. So Stein asked, what if after you died, you ran into God? And he said, what have you been doing, Richard? I mean, what have you been doing? I've been trying to be nice to you. I gave you a multi-million-dollar paycheck over and over again with your book, and look what you did. And here's Dawkins' response. Bertrand Russell had that pointed out to him, and he said something like, sir, why did you take such pains to hide yourself? That sounds like a pretty good answer, doesn't it? Is God hiding, though? Here's our passage of Scripture for the night. There in the book of Romans, chapter 1, beginning in verse 19, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. As I mentioned, all of these quotes came from a movie with Ben Stein. Richard Dawkins has a lecture on YouTube. You can look it up there, titled The Art of Quote Mining, where he claims that certain creationists go and steal little snippets and don't give the whole picture. And he goes on to talk about this very exchange. And he says he would never have agreed to be put on that if he would have known exactly what it was. And I'll be the first to admit that documentaries are not exactly honest in their way of getting information out of individuals. Michael Moore has made millions of dollars doing it. And I wouldn't deny that others on every side of the question would do the same thing. So I grant that to you, Mr. Dawkins. He goes on to say that he was trying to give creation its best shot. Said he doesn't believe in this. He just remembered this was something that had been proposed by another individual. The idea of directed panspermia, originally proposed by Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel in 1973 and was used by William Dembski to show that intelligent design did not have to refer to God. And he said, that's the best shot you have for intelligent design was aliens. He says, I don't believe it. But if there were ever a case for intelligent design, that's the best you've got. Does it take faith to believe in God? Oh, yeah. Categorically and emphatically, it takes faith to believe in God. But let's think about it for a moment. To believe in creation, we have to believe in one thing, an all-powerful God like we read in the Bible. That's it. That's the only thing you have to look at to have faith in. To believe in science, you've got to believe in the scientist. You've got to believe they really know what they're talking about. You've got to believe in the assumptions that they use to create the dates that they find. You've got to believe their honesty in presenting to you all of the information that they discover. You've got to believe that they know what happened during those billions of years they claim to have been upon this earth, and they know exactly what happened to those rocks that they're studying. It takes a lot more faith to believe in evolution. Now, in my introduction, I mentioned several movies and television shows. I want to let you know my daughter has seen all of them. My son has seen most of them. In fact, he loves to watch Dinosaur Train. I don't think there's anything wrong with letting our children watch these things as long as they're taught the truth. As long as they're giving the opposing side. I have no problems, to be honest with you. I have no problems whatsoever with the theory of evolution being taught in the school systems. As long as creationism is taught right there beside it. As long as both sides of the coin are thrown at them and they can sit down and they can look at the facts that are presented to them and they can see the world and they can come to their conclusion instead of having it crammed down their throats. That's where I have a problem. Because in school systems, in universities, creation is not allowed. So I leave you with the Apostle Paul's answer to Mr. Dawkins. Why did you hide yourself? Been here the whole time, is what God says. I've shown myself in everything. You look at a car, you know what make it is, don't you? Because a certain car makes a certain model in a certain way, right? Watches, if you look at them, you can tell the difference between a Rolex and a fake Rolex, can't you? You can see the design. You can see the intent. Is there a God? Oh yeah. There's a God. He is evident. Tomorrow night, Lord willing, we're going to talk about what He wants from us. Is the Bible truly the inspired Word of God? Is it His last message to mankind? And what does it tell us that we need to do? I hope that you'll join us again tomorrow evening. I appreciate so much your lengthy attention. You just wouldn't believe the amount of material that's still sitting on my desk that got left on the cutting room floor. Dan tried to give me some more yesterday. I said, buddy, I got so much material, I can't even use it all. Thanks, but I'll look at it later. The evidence for God is here. And the opportunity to express your belief in Him is right here, tonight. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, it's rather simple. Jesus just asks one thing of you. Just believe that He is the Son of God. And do His will. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Do you believe that He came to this earth, died upon the cross, that we could have forgiveness of our sins? That we who are unworthy could be made worthy in God's eyes? If you do, then come forward and confess that belief. Repent of the sins of your life. Turn your life over to God in humble submission by being baptized. If you've never obeyed the gospel, now is your time. If you've obeyed the gospel, but you've allowed the world to begin to create in you an idea, well, maybe it is billions of years old. Maybe the Bible doesn't really know what it's talking about. Perhaps I've shown you that science is full of assumptions, lies, and a lot of faith. Perhaps you've turned your attention back to God and seen that He is the Creator of all things and you need to devote your life to Him once more. Then tonight is your opportunity. Make your life right with God as we stand and as we sing.